CNN projects Joseph R. Biden Jr. is elected the 46th president of the United States, winning the White House and denying President Trump a second term.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That was the moment we've been waiting for 4 days for. CNN making their projection. Wolf Blitzer, an institution over there in the US media, calling it for Joseph R. Biden, the 46th president-elect of the United States of America, denying Trump a second term and giving America a chance to reset and actually tackle the coronavirus pandemic, which some have labeled a now humanitarian crisis that is taking over the United States as it reaches new heights across the South and across the Midwest. Speaking of the Midwest, Joe, how are you today, mate?
Mate, I'm bloody unreal. Happy to welcome another Joe B to the roundtable. Got myself, Joey Biden, and Joe Burrow, Cincinnati Bengals quarterback. It's a pretty exclusive club, so welcome, Mr. Biden.
And just on that note, anyone with the initials JB, you just know they're going to be a good bloke. James Brayshaw, JBL and the WWE, you name it, they're all going to be top sort of people. So there you have it in terms of Biden being elected. But those Midwest states, those North, the blue wall as they call it, they went back to Biden after being going to Trump in 2016. I'm talking Wisconsin, I'm talking Pennsylvania, I'm talking Michigan, and I'm talking the boys up there in the Detroit and the 6th District up there. But moving on now, the projected votes for Trump, 232 for Trump v 306 for Biden. So quite a big victory in the end. It's actually a flip of what Trump beat Clinton by in 2016. What message does this send, Joe? I think it's a message of persistence and common decency. He's liked by people on both sides of the aisle. You know, he's a decent man. You know, by his record in the Senate, first elected in 1972. He knows the institutions and the process as well and how to get the most out of a federal government. He's also been beset by personal tragedy. He's lost his first wife and daughter in a car accident in 1972 as well. And also his son, Beau, passed away in 2015 from brain cancer. So he's certainly been beset by personal tragedy, and for someone to pick himself up off the canvas like that and continue to deliver and think about others before himself, I certainly goes to show like what sort of caliber of a man we've got here in Biden. I think he'll be a one-term president, but also like to see Kamala Harris, the first ever a female vice president, let alone being a woman of color, breaking down those goddamn glass ceilings that women are so often inhibited by. I think it's a winner all around and brings some hope and decency, not only to the US but indeed the diplomatic world in terms of negotiations and a free world that we live in.
That's it, mate. Yes, it's unreal. It's exciting. I'm glad it's not just a repeat. You know, I mean, who knows the backlash it would have brought on if Trump came through. But good to see a whitewash instead of Trump's washed white voters. So that's very encouraging. Very excited to see Kamala Harris come in as well. Let alone the barriers she's breaking, just hearing her speak and her victory acceptance a few days ago now was very heartwarming, very true. I trusted her, felt honest. There was no dancing around the fact that her and Biden have disagreed in the past, and she acknowledges that, and they know they're not perfect. They know they're not the perfect match, but the fact that they're so willing to work together is quite encouraging. Based on the fact that they're there to do a job for other people and not themselves, which I feel like is America's let slip in Trump's term. It's become more about him as opposed to the people he's representing. But there's a few issues that he's going to have to tackle immediately. His first 100 days is going to be jam-packed. So I think a lot of it's going to be virus-based. So that's going to be interesting to see how that turns out. He's fallen into a bit of a spot. He's not just dealing with the virus as it is, he's dealing with the neglect of Trump's action on the virus. So he's not just dealing with the pandemic, he's dealing with the issues that have arisen in American politics around the virus, and he's got a lot of work to do. But I think he can get the job done. The help with Harris is very exciting to see.
Yeah, and speaking off air before the episode started, that you're getting a bit fired up. Now, here at Political Football, we're dealing facts and not speculation or alternative facts. something that Trump's been entertaining is, you know, there's been voter fraud. We're not going to even discuss that on this podcast, made the executive decision, because it's not even worth giving bated breath to. But that leads to the new segment we've got going. Joe, we've got it called Fire Up.
I'm fired up, mate.
You're fired up. Fired up are you?
I am so fired up. I nearly burn a hole in my car roof coming here, mate. I'm steaming. I'm steaming at the moment.
From the cathedral land, he's got a few tailwinds coming over.
Oh, I'm coming in hot, mate. It's been crushing me a little bit in the past couple of weeks that Trump's denial of losing and his unwillingness to accept loss has fired me up, because it's now not even about politics for him, or for me at least. It's not about politics. I see someone, one of the biggest role model positions in the world right now, if not the biggest, setting an example to kids, young adults, children, young professionals in the workplace, that if you take a loss, if you complain about it and complain and whinge and moan, you can try reverse it into your and into having it your way. And it's a pathetic trait to have, and it gets my blood boiling. It's not something that should be celebrated like it is. It gets so much media attention, so much ratings on TV. It's all people talk about wherever you go, on the street, all over Australian media, about him not accepting his loss. Like, the fact that we even give it a breath of time is pathetic. It's just schoolyard. I didn't get my way. I'm going to go out kicking and screaming. Pathetic. No sportsmanship. It's honestly an embarrassment. And I see it having a big effect on young kids who might admire him or think he's funny, or young professionals in the workplace who might maybe have a slip up, lose their position at work, and they act the same way because they think it's okay, because you've got one of the biggest, most powerful person in the world acting like that. So it's now, I don't want this to become socially acceptable. I think Biden and political leaders all across the world, especially here in Australia, need to drill home sportsmanship, acceptance of a decision, and resilience.
Yeah.
And that's nothing, that Trump is showing none of those traits at the moment, and mate, it fires me up.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, you've got me fired up after that segment, and we've got plenty more for where that came from in coming weeks. But introduction of a new segment there, let us know your thoughts. But just getting back to your point that you raised there, and philosophically, I think it cannot be questioned. You make an outstanding point. Going to the Republican Party and where they stand going forward is it's a sad blight on the state of the Republican Party, that Trump is effectively the Republican Party now, and you have these people around him who are scared to stand up to him, like Mitch McConnell and a variety of other senior senators and senior party members. You just can't accept it. And you look at people like John McCain and even George W. Bush. You might agree with them until the cows come home in relation to their economic or social policy or whatever. But they never question the democratic institutions that sort of are the foundations of the United States of America. And indeed, you know, the sort of the touchstone of what democracy around the world looks like, even if it is a sort of a cancerous form of it. But this is just a sad blot on the Republican Party, and those people who don't stand up now, it'll be a point in history that won't be forgotten. So if you're listening to the podcast, I know we have a big reach over there in the United States of America, especially amongst the Republican Party. If you're listening,
fan base.
Stand up. And show some gumption and you know, call it out for what it is. Joe Biden's won the presidency. It was a fair and democratic process, and that's the way it goes. But
the danger is this can't become a norm.
Yeah.
This behavior can't become a norm. It's so harmful. If this is now the standard of an end of term for a president or a prime minister or whatever you want to, whoever wants to be your leader, it's so dangerous. It's like the American people are so divided. There's so much conflict because of this whole situation. And now if this is the standard, where if someone's leaving office from the future, what's stopping this from causing so much harm in the streets, riots, all that behavior we've seen the whole year? This just needs to be shunned immediately and shut down. Not that people aren't allowed to voice their opinions, because that's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is from the leaders themselves.
And they incite this sort of violence.
This needs to be shut down. Anyone who behaves like this needs to be sanctioned or cautioned or something, because it's pathetic and it's more harmful than what we're just seeing now. The future implications of this could be horrific.
Yep. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it there. Certainly ramifications, you know, they're bound to be coming soon. But yeah, hopefully a grain of salt, a grain of hope with the presidency of Biden, the incoming president of Biden. So we'll see how we go there. But moving on now to our second topic that we're going to cover in the political sphere this week, something a bit closer to home. Something that's been very...
close to my home.
Yeah, that's right. Certainly down there in the old Canberra bubble. It's our reaction to the Four Corners episode this week. We sort of revealed some inappropriate and misconduct, sort of, and inappropriate behaviour from some senior Canberra ministers, including Immigration Minister Alan Tudge and the big sleaze himself, Christian Porter. Your thoughts on this, Joe? Do you want to give a bit of a detail to our listeners for those who didn't catch up with the program?
Yeah, so basically we've had a few female representatives in Parliament come out and uncover a whole bunch of male behaviour that's has been absolutely deemed unacceptable in around Parliament House in Canberra. Not just the way they act within Parliament House, but the way they act on their own time in public and in their off time as well. So we've seen a few accusations made against some ministers, and the shockwave was huge. The next day it was all over our media. One of the only things that's actually retaken back over our media after the US election, I found. Yeah, I mean, I was watching the episode with my dad. I was down in Canberra at the time, and we both thought this is gonna cause some stuff here. So, I'd like to get your thoughts on it, because I know we were messaging each other throughout, but I haven't seen you since then. So
just a bit of clarification. So Alan Tudge, he had a consensual affair with one of his staff. I think she was a press secretary for a couple of years there, Rochelle Miller, who's actually went public with the revelations on the program. So there's not any, if you can speak about Tudge first, there's not any conjecture about sexual harassment or sexual assault or anything on those lines. It was both consensual. They were both married at the time. But I didn't care what you do in your private life. I wouldn't care if Tudge was sleeping with Arthur or Martha. That's none of my business. And people can do whatever, what they want in their private life, as long as it's consensual. And Parliament, you'd be a fool to think it's not just another microcosm of society. Affairs happen all over the place. You know, it is a highly charged environment down there. It's long hours. It's a drinking culture there. You know, it's high energy. It sort of conduces that sort of thing. But what I do have a clear problem with, it's almost my beef for the week here, is the inability to treat female staff as equals in the workplace. And also the fact that he goes out there and he campaigned against the same-sex marriage yes vote to say, like, he believes in the institution of marriage. You know, it's very important. He portrays himself as a family man. And then you go and conduct yourself behind closed doors in this sort of manner, right? There's one thing to go have an affair, but there's one thing to be a hypocrite. The hypocrisy around this is nothing short of disgraceful. And I just find it's always those who preach the loudest against something like the same-sex marriage bill or, you know, being a traditional conservative white male who go out there and conduct themselves in the absolute most disgraceful light possible. And that's what I have a serious, serious issue with. As former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said so eloquently, the pools are deepest at the feet of the sanctimonious. Now, I'm not sure where he plucked that one from, whether that's Shakespeare or whatever it is, but he needs to trademark that one, because it couldn't describe the situation better. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this here, because, again, she's the one who got all the ramifications for this. She got moved to Michaela Cash's office a couple months after the affair had broken up, and then 6 months she was made redundant, and since then she hasn't been able to get a job back in Parliament. Now, from my understanding, she got 10 years of experience. She was an above-average sort of press secretary. There was no reason, given some of the calibre of people who operate in Parliament, that why she shouldn't be able to get a job. But yet she cops all the ramifications, and Alan Tudge, who wouldn't know immigration from a bar of soap, still has his job as minister. That's what I have a serious issue with.
Yeah, he's got some things to work out right now. I mean, from her point of view, she, as you said, she's an experienced press secretary. She's put her time in the field and she's losing her jobs and being swept to the side. I think this, she could have done this a lot earlier. She could have come out with this a lot earlier. She would have been dwelling on it. It would have been stressing her out. I can't imagine it being any easy task to come out there. She would have felt like it's one against the rest of Australia. So for her to come out and say what she said takes a lot of guts, and I'm glad it's has the traction that it has already, because it's opened some people's eyes to some things. Because I'll say I was pretty clueless to all of this before. I absolutely would have had no idea. So I'm glad this is brought to our attention. He was actually brought up last night too. There was a segment on ABC News. There was a family they were immigrants from Sri Lanka. The father had just died from cancer, so now they're facing deportation. The kids have grown up here for the past 10, 15 years, and I don't know, they're trying to reach out to him in order for some visa stuff. I don't know the full details of it, but so he's under fire from multiple aspects. I'm just thinking maybe there's more to it here. Maybe his time's up. He's pushed a few buttons with some people, and the air's coming out on him now. So absolutely unacceptable. As you said, he was campaigning against gay marriage, and he's there. I feel like his ability to do that is just trying to cover up and hide his own issues that he's got going on.
Yeah.
It's just complete hypocrisy.
And Rochelle Miller's now made a formal complaint to the Department of Finance to investigate these matters for recourse. And again, the ministers in this position have a very strong position of power. They have the ability to effectively hire and sack workers at their will with no sort of justification as to why or why not. You know, it's a sort of a very, the power operates from the minister level and you don't have much responsibility there. And it's nearly always, especially with the coalition government, a male minister and female staffers. And that leaves them in a position, you know, for them to be exposed to a variety of unsavoury and in some cases bullying in the workplace. And that's what the case she's made. There's been one time when they were at the airport and he kept making it a reference to something. I can't remember what it was when I read the article, but it made her cry, and she was on the plane, she was brought to tears. You know, no one should be subject to that in the workplace, and I hope it does get followed up. And if Scott Morrison is the man he supposedly perpetrates himself to be, he's a man of Christian faith, well then he should follow this up and seek ramification for it, because I'm sure there's someone else who could come in and do just as good a job as Alan Tudge. So we'll see what the machinations are there. I'll say there won't be any, because when it comes to actually following up and getting stuff done and changing cultural behaviour, ScoMo's nowhere to be seen. But moving on now to the other person, the other senior minister who was exposed or alleged for sort of misconduct and inappropriate behaviour in the Canberra bubble, and that is the Attorney General Christian Porter. Now, I'd even heard rumours before this that he was a sleaze. So in terms of, having extramarital affairs outside of his marriage, and this came as no surprise, but it's just the level of entitled behavior and misogynistic behavior, and the thing he went caught. I mean, people, you know, he's denying the rumors in 2018 that he was caught at the Canberra public bar in Canberra, whatever it's called, hooking up with one of his staffers. I mean, there's five or six people that vouched there, you know, and someone took a photo of it and they agreed to delete it at the time because I think it wasn't intruding on someone's personal life. But again, he perpetrates himself as his family man, you know, from Western Australia, believes in traditional values of the Liberal Party, being a good man of Christian faith, and he goes ahead and conducts himself in this light. Now, he is the Attorney General. He is the first law officer of this country, and he conducts himself like that. And he, as Turnbull said in the program, it leaves yourself open to potential blackmail, either from the former lover or someone from a former government. You know, with all those, you know, espionage occurs, you know, down in Canberra, people try and, you know, manipulate things for their own personal advantage. So that leaves yourself open for that. And he sits on the National Security Commission. I mean, it's just beyond belief. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, sounds like he's a bit of a liability. And not only that, but he's a distraction, it sounds like. I mean, there's got to be some sort of some sort of system in place where people are reminded when they come into a job like that, there's some things they might have to sacrifice. I mean, it's up to him whether he wants to behave like that in his own time, but if he's stepping into a public role, a big role in Australian leadership, I mean, he's got to sacrifice this crap. And whether it's good or not, he's got to put his job above the way he wants to behave on the weekend at the pub. He's not going to be there for his whole life. If he's in the job now, he has to put his attention to the job. And that's not to say he can't go out for a beer and relax at the pub. It's just the way you behave and how much you have at the pub. Public's, mate, it's a stone toss away from my joint down there.
What's it like? What's the vibe down like
there? It's all right. It is a hub for politicians. You also get footy players, you know. You see some people down there and, yeah, it's not surprising at all.
Have you ever been paparazzi down there?
I can't keep them away. Just crowd the windows, man. I can't go anywhere down there anymore after, you know, put on a fancy hat or something. But, yeah, I mean, it doesn't shock me. This isn't the first time I've heard anything to do with public bar being in politicians, not to discredit public bar because it's a great establishment. I'm just saying the people that tend to go there. Yeah, you hear stuff about it all the time. Just be more careful.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's okay the way they behave, but whatever you do, even when you go, mate, you go to the toilet and you're a politician.
Yeah.
Make sure your window's close.
Yeah.
Be careful.
That's right. And I think what we're trying to get to here is a broader point around ethics. You know, when you become
I got a bit sidetracked.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. I'm sure their viewers engage with that. Now they've got a camera, they'll be hitting that public bar for sure. You know.
Yeah. Take your cameras, take your notepads, get some. Right.
But when you become a minister, you automatically subscribe to a sense of behaviour and a sort of a commitment to behaviour that is beyond the ordinary citizen. Because you're representing the public, you're the public face of your electorate or wherever you're representing, right? And you have to act in the most judicial and professional way possible, because you know your whole career is built off public funds. You know, anything involving public funds, and it's complete transparency around it. And you know, you need to conduct yourself in an appropriate manner. No one's saying you can't have a private life. No one's saying you can't have a relationship, but to conduct yourself in that sort of public, brazen way, and then to preach something else, to preach and not practice what you preach. I mean, that is the hypocrisy at its finest. So. And getting back to this, again, there's been no ramifications so far for Porter or Tudge, but one of the women who spoke out against Porter, calling him a misogynist from his time at University of Western Australia, they studied law together. I think he might have been even her tutor at one point in time. Kathleen Foley, this week she was voted off the Victorian Bar Council. Now, let me qualify this by saying that there was a two-week voting process, so it maybe didn't have that much of an effect on it, but you can't tell me that this sort of, in the legal community, this word wouldn't have spread that this program was being aired. Porter knew people were being contacted around him, and it might have been a broader sort of sense of amongst the bar. It was an election after all, but you know, she's got the punishment. Whether it's coincidental or not, it's just a bad look, right? Here again, we have female people speaking out, and they're the ones copping the punishment and not the people who have perpetrated the bad behaviour or inappropriate behaviour in the first place. And that's a cultural shift that needs to change. And I think that's what we're trying to get to here amongst these instances. This is just one amongst many. You know, there's no doubt it's happened on the Labor side too. I'm sure there's, you know, some stories from there down there too. But it's conduct yourself in that sort of light and to say something else in public. You know, people often draw links and parallels between this behaviour and the treatment of Porter, Tudge and Barnaby Joyce back when Malcolm Turnbull introduced the bonk ban, as it's sort of euphemistically called. But Hawke was never a hypocrite. He never went out there preaching this family man sort of thing. He was a larrikin. He was flawed. There were, you know, just like the rest of us, we're all flawed. But he wasn't a hypocrite and he wasn't a conservative. And that's the key difference here, right? He would never came out and, you know, I know probably gay marriage wasn't on the agenda back in the 80s and 90s. But he certainly was coming out and campaigning against something like the institution of marriage, you know, that they campaigned against. So any final thoughts on this, Joe? Or you reckon we've covered it off pretty well?
I think we've covered it pretty well. Just bringing it home that I guess there has to be more, just because there may not be any legal accusations made or room for legal punishment. I think this is a good chance for the government and the government systems to start to be more in tune with the behavior they want in representing them and the country. So just because it's not legally actionable, take action on behavior and start to think about the people and the kinds of acts you want representing your country and your people.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Pretty comprehensive wrap-up there. Let us know your thoughts. We'd love to get your thoughts on this issue. Some people have said, you know, this should completely remain in the private sphere. Other people like myself and Joe have argued that it's a public interest test and certainly needs to be held up to a standard of accountability and responsibility for ministers. But let us know your thoughts, and we'll be back shortly with a whole comprehensive wrap of sport, including Origin 2 and introducing the 17-man squad and our thoughts on the upcoming summer of cricket. Let's go.
Catch.
Hi, Trevor Smith here, spokesperson for the Department of Finance. Are you a former government staffer who was forced out the door after you stood up to ministerial bullying? Well, the Department of Finance is the place for you to make your complaint. While we can't seek recourse or take any actions on your behalf, we'll sure as hell pretend as we're doing something for you. Department of Finance. Spreadsheets and complaints. That's what we do.
Trbojevic and gone to clearing. It's now with Tedesco. He's over. Captain James Tedesco. Player of the year last year.
Welcome back to Political Football, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that little introduction there with, as Rabbits Warren like to call him, Captain James.
James Tedesco. It's one of the only times of the year that I can get around him after his betrayal, leaving the Tigers for the Roosters, as we well know for all our long-time listeners here at the pod. But it's one time of the year that I can appreciate his greatness. And again, showing it last Wednesday night, this past Wednesday night, I should say, with an absolute display for the ages. 200 plus metres a try, 2 tries, 6, 4 tackle breaks. The man's a stat breaking machine. Joe, please continue before I interrupted you there.
That's all right, mate. It was it got me really excited for this segment. So the last time we broke the Spotify records for streaming was last Wednesday, prior to game one. So game two happened a couple of days ago. We'll run through those two games, how they compared to each other, where New South Wales made their best efforts to improve, where Queensland slipped up, could have gone better. We'll go into some more free agency around rugby league, something is specifically close to my my host Tommy Pooley's heart. And then we're going to get into some cricket with the summer upcoming just around the corner now, the last footy game happening next Wednesday with Origin, and then right into the best, one of the best times of year for me, summer of cricket. I'm pumped for it, mate. So kick us off, Tom, with what you thought game one.
Game one, well, this is very disappointing. Game one for New South Wales fans like yourself and me. I always felt there was a bit of a danger attached to it that, you know, New South Wales were effectively declared winners before the game actually started. You can never write Queensland off. Queensland are probably the team that make Origin, given their hatred for those of south of the border, including Anastasia Palaszczuk, who seems to be permanently locking up the border for those New South Welshmen. Keir Munster, he had a great game. DC, he played all right, which is rare for him. But I just thought that New South Wales went into the game with a lack of a game plan. They were relying more on individual brilliance. And as they say in the classics, a champion team always beats a team of champions. And that was the case for game one. Now, I always felt confident going into game two that if New South Wales pulled their finger out and actually put together a bit of a game plan, a bit more forward momentum. I like the restructure of the bench with Finucane and the like coming off the bench there. I thought Isaiah Yeo was a great injection to the team, as well as Nathan Brown. Well, I think he was always keeping an eye out for Sean Bloor coming from the crowd, somewhere nice to take him out, even though they're fellow teammates in the coming years for New South Wales.
Crush a tackle.
penalty. I thought Tedesco, Addo Carr, and Nathan Cleary, to an extent, stood up and developed the game plan, kick long, chase hard, could press the defense, and they did exactly that. And the class of like Cody Walker, Jack White, and in a specific moment, and as I said, Tedesco, they proved just too much for Queensland, who I thought when Munster got taken off with the HIA in that first couple minutes of the game, that was the game right there, because he is the key to their victory.
Yeah, quite disappointing to see him come off. Obviously, the caliber of a player he is brings a lot of excitement, but I was pumped, mate. I mean, you know, you need that win. You need the game to win. I'm not gonna be disappointed when Munster walks off the field. I mean, poor bloke. I hope he's all right, the mad dog. But you know, it's a game after all. But I will. There's one thing I will come back to and disagree with you on was game one. I thought it was the opposite. I thought they came in with a clear game plan, but the trouble was they weren't willing to throw it out the window when opportunities arose for themselves. There was too much structure. Cleary wasn't running the ball. There was no improvisation, no excitement until the last 10 to 15 minutes when they started throwing the ball wide to their speed men out back, trying to make some space around the edges. And I feel like they finally got back in touch with them, with who they are as a team, a bunch of young individual brilliant players with speed, agility, and great attacking ability. So I will disagree with you there, but I'm not losing sleep.
Sorry, live in democracy, mate.
But and I feel like we saw revered in game two. I feel like they came in with a game plan, but they were willing to throw it out the window when opportunities arose to use their speed, use their attacking ability. Nathan Cleary is running the ball, looking dangerous as ever. Yeah, so very encouraging. Also, it just looked like in game one, a few of the players are a bit laggy. You could tell they haven't played in a few weeks. Like the Newcastle blokes, for example, just looked a bit slow, looked a bit out of touch. But a week after footy brought back in, another week of training, that was cleaned up to a large extent in game two. They look faster, sharper, less mistakes. I guess more game fit. I mean, it's hard to tell as a fan sometimes, but the consistency of the play just held up across the whole game, as opposed to game one where there were large sections and patches where players were tired, mistakes were made, and effort wasn't there. So the leap from game one to game two was huge. New South Wales improved a lot, but as you came over to my house to watch it, actually, and never forgetting from the first whistle to the last was Queensland's spirit. And no matter what anyone says about the team they have on the field, they're one of the most spirited sporting teams out there, and you can never count them out.
Yeah.
Never.
And your thoughts on... I thought it was quite a key tactical change in the sense that what gets the best out of Nathan Cleary is a running 5'8". Luke Keary, I really like Luke Keary as a player. I think he's a bit hard done by just to get one bite at the cherry. But in the sense that he doesn't complement Cleary, because I know Cleary plays 5'8", but he's almost like a halfback in the control that he exerts over the game. He plays on both sides of the ruck. He pops in a first receiver as well as playing second receiver sometimes. I feel like his game style doesn't complement as much as Cody Walker's game style complements Cleary. Like Cody Walker takes more of that instinctual eyes at football that same as like Jerome Luai, you know, in the Penrith system. And you could see there was much more sort of Penrith tone to it, less structure and more sort of playing flat over the advantage line. And that really helped Nathan Cleary. Now, if Nathan Cleary is going to be your number one gun for 10 years, then you might have to sacrifice, you know, Keary, who's probably the, you know, I'd put him in the top five players in the game, you know, for that team success. So I feel Luke Keary has been hard done by, and I feel like we'll get another chance, no doubt, given the calibre of player he is. But in the New South Wales current system of playing, I think Cody Walker made a significant difference in terms of his ability to play. Now, you know how hot his form was in the back half of the season and into the finals campaign for South Sydney. Your thoughts on that? Do you think, obviously, that was a winning formula on Wednesday night for a comprehensive victory?
Yeah, I think the decision to start Walker was, I think, completely based on a point-scoring mentality and a game-winning mentality. If it were me, I think Keary is your suited guy to go out there with a lead and win a game and hold a game for your team. But obviously, Cody Walker's the guy to go out there and attack and get you a win. So to me, if I don't know if that makes sense, but how I'm thinking of it is, I would have gone in to game one with Walker to lock in that first game one win, and then maybe gone into game two with Keary and controlled the game, slow it down a bit, maybe a bit less points, less excitement, less attack, but he's the guy who could get out there and hold yeah. your position at the top. Not to say that Walker can't do that, because he obviously played unreal and was a massive part of the team during on Wednesday's match, and I dare say he'll be there and again on next Wednesday. But yeah, I think Luke Keary is that guy who's gritty and he controls the game well, but Cody Walker is suiting that Origin team right now when points are needed and games are on the line, like series is on the line. You got to go out there and score some more points than the other team, and at this point, Cody Walker's the best guy for that job.
And now looking forward to game three, decided in Suncorp, but doesn't get much better than that. Now, I do think the viewership has been lacking this time of the year. I think Origin will be returning to the mid season window as it is traditionally before COVID hit. But maybe decided next week can really really liven up the series. You know, even though Wednesday night's game was, it was a pretty good game, but probably better than game one in the sense that it was a higher quality game, but it still felt a bit like a club game in a sense. And I think game three, I think it'll explode. A bit of hiss-hoss between Payne Haas and Tina Fasu Malawi, which was great to see. I think Paul Kent was agitating for that all week. But both cleared the play in this decider.
I love that.
They could have
blown that up. Like we saw in the rugby union, 4 weeks for an accidental high tackle. You're kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
So they could have made a meal of that. That a couple of punches were thrown in that little his hoss, but no one's hurt. No one's crying. Everyone's safe. Let the boys play.
Yeah. And your thoughts on this game? Who wins and by how much and why?
Game three. Ooh, jeez. I'd like to say New South Wales win, but it's not going to be a game two score on. I think we're going to see a close game. I mean, this series is almost a reflection of last year. It's unfolded the exact same way as last year unfolded. So if that's said anything for the whole series so far, it means game three is going to be close and it's going to be physical. So I'd like to say New South Wales based on my biases, but you never know. I mean, Queensland have shown they can beat this team. I'm pumped.
Yeah, it's Origin again. I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully we can get a few of the boys around and watch the game together like we do at game one. But I think the key difference here being that game three last year was held at ANZ Stadium in front of a parochial New South Wales crowd. Well, if you think that was parochial, wait till you see game three and wait till you see Caxton Street up there in Brizzy. I imagine they can have up to 40,000-45,000 up there at Suncorp, close to capacity. And we know Queensland grow an extra leg when they play up there. So it'll be very interesting to see. I'm looking at New South Wales by about 8. I just think the class, there's just multiple ways for New South Wales to win. I think Queensland, the only way they can win is sort of grind that victory as they did in game one, score a couple of unsuspecting tries. We'll see about the state of Cam Munster. Obviously, AJ Brimson, I think he's out as well again. Val Holmes was pretty quiet in that game two.
In saying that, the majority of the Queensland team was quiet. Yeah, yeah. I don't think I saw Gagai once.
Yeah.
I think New South Wales just did a great job of keeping the ball in their own hands. Yeah. A lot of the Queensland players were quiet in game two. So
anyway, hopefully this game makes a series and we'll be looking forward to that. But moving on now to something close to myself's heart, given my return to the cricket arena on Sunday for the first time since school. Didn't go too well individually. Didn't trouble the score as much, but I happily sacrificed that for team success any day of the week, given the team player that I am. And we got the bonus point win, so you've got to respect that. But moving on to something a bit more important than a fifth grade Shires competition, we'll talk about the Australian Test Team v India. Now, this was a squad announced, I believe, yesterday morning, a squad of 17. Joe, do you want to run through some of the key selections there?
I will. I'll drop the names of the whole squad before we dive into the most interesting selections. Obviously, Tim Payne, skipper. We're bringing in Sean Abbott, Joe Burns, Pat Cummins, Cameron Green, Josh Hazelwood, Travis Head, Manus Labuschagne, Nathan Lyon, Michael Nessa, James Pattinson, Will Pekowski, Steve Smith, Mitchell Stark, Mitchell Swepson, Matty Wade, and Davey the Worn Man Warner.
Yeah, so some very interesting selections here. Obviously, you've got the staple selection who they've cemented their spot for multiple years in the team there. I'm talking to the likes of Vice Captain Patrick Cummins, the man they call the cider. I wonder why they call it that. Josh Hazlewood, obviously, great. You know, that whole cartel, you can't question it. Cummins, Hazlewood, Stark.
Wouldn't be a summer without them.
Yeah, exactly. They're the cartel, as they call it, the cartel corner in the locker room they have. Jimmy Patterson, I imagine, will be knocking on the door at some stage to get a game. He's obviously the fourth pillar of that cartel.
Not a bad backup to have in your pocket.
And then you've obviously got Nathan Lyon. I mean, I wonder how many times he gets that one. Coming in there as a spinner, obviously the GOAT, as they call him, the greatest off spinner Australia's ever seen, arguably the world. But interesting, while we're on the spinners, for all those spinners corners out there that listen to our podcast, Mitchell Swepson, the leggy from the Queensland Bulls, he's been lighting it up this Sheffield's season so far. He's taken a bag of fifers, removed some key wickets, tore through New South Wales in a nail-biting match, and New South Wales won by a wicket. I think, potentially, we might see him in the Sydney Test. This is a big projection, much like the CNN Key Race Alert. This is a big projection. We've got a Key Race Alert. Mitchell Swepson for the SCG Test. I just think with the amount of versatility in this squad, with the likes of Cameron Green, Nessa, and Sean Abbott included. That's three quality all-rounders. Cameron Green being a batting all-rounder, and Nessa and Abbott being bowling all-rounders. By the fourth test, obviously, against India, it's going to be a high-octane summer. I could see them playing Lyon, Swepson, and then one of those all-rounders coming in and making their debut. If not, they don't make it beforehand. But your thoughts on the bowling lineup first off. What do you like to see?
I think, as it's been announced with Kohli, he'll play one test and he'll go back home for the birth of his child. Is it son? Daughter? I don't know.
We'll find out. Probably one of those gender reveals.
If it's not Steve Smith, I don't really care. bloody Kohli. I think, personally, you'll see, and I mean, I could be completely out of the boat here, but I think you'll see Nathan Lyon as the only spinner for that Kohli game. Yeah. And then I think they'll be a little bit more experimental after Kohli leaves. I mean, I know there's still India's depth of talent is ridiculous, but he out of all of their team, knows how to play over here the best. So I think we'll see a pace lineup in that first test, and then I think you might see two spinners come in for the rest of the series after Kohli leaves. That's just my opinion. But
I don't think we'll see two spinners until Sydney. These are the decks that you're playing on when you've got Adelaide, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney, of course. Unfortunately, WACA or the Optus Stadium is missing out on one, given our recent success against India. But it's good that there is a test being played at the Gabba, because we are effectively unbeaten there since the Cows have come home. But I think that fast bowling quartet, you know, they can definitely. We know they've got the ability to take 20 wickets on any surface. The question I have will be over the MCG wicket. We know that's been an absolute road and nothing in it for the last couple of years.
Is there guaranteed there's going to be a game there? I mean,
yeah, it's guaranteed. It's been cemented. The Boxing Day test there. With the New Year test starting a bit later this year, I think it's at the
7th. Crowds in Melbourne?
I think they're planning on having a crowd here, up to 40,000.
In Melbourne?
Yeah. Well, they've become better than us, mate. They've just reached 14 days, zero.
Yeah, I know, but, down there, you don't know what they're up to, those fellas.
Yeah, they've suppressed it down there in Mexico.
Taylor Jones, if you're listening, long-time listener, I know you might be out there, mate, but keep it easy, keep it sleazy, mate.
thanks, Taylor, for listening. Appreciate your support. But moving on now, something close to my heart, giving that I am a batsman, even though I've coined myself as a batting all-rounder, which is a stretch of the truth. we'll look at the batting lineup here. Now, I've locked in, this is my top six, and I want to get your thoughts on it. I've gone Warner, Pekowski, Lasagna, Smith, Head, and Wade. with an asterisk on Wade that I would potentially make way for Cameron Green.
Hmm. See, I was, my six is almost the exact same, but I'd interchange Head for Green. So, right,
okay, so
I have Wade. I think I definitely have Wade in there. Head, yeah, I'd be willing to pull the trigger on replace, giving Cameron Green a couple of runs. It's good to see those young fellas come through. And I mean, if you get the chance, if we've secured or we're looking to secure a series win, I think we need to pump those young fellas in there.
Yeah.
Keep your start. Like, we need to keep the stars in. We need cricket to be entertaining all summer. So we need our Smiths, our Lasagnas and Davey Warner. But I think it's of ample importance to bring Pukowski, Green in wherever they can in the next couple of years, because these are the guys of the future and we need Australia to be around them as soon as they've cemented their spot in the team. So, yeah, I would be ready and willing to pull the trigger on Green in the lineup at any point.
And I was looking over some of his footage last night. He's got a very strong technique for it. It's some tall timber. He's got a very strong technique. Good front foot press, which is always the key for test match cricket. The ability to negate that swinging ball, that swinging new ball. Pukowski, I think it's been important that we talk about him. I think he's hit over 450 runs in two matches, two double centuries back to back. I've got him coming in over Joe Burns, who was all right last summer. I think he averaged like got 250 odd runs at it. About 35, which isn't too bad, but I just think Pukowski's time has come. He's a run scoring machine. Now, looking at some of his highlights, great square of the wicket. Reminds me a bit of punting, a bit of Phil Hughes about him. Who's just anything on that fifth, sixth stump line, or something that strays on the leg stump. He's put into the boundary. He's got a very good strong game. He does look a bit vulnerable to that ball being pitched up, especially early on, but I suppose if you're an opener, you're subject to that swinging ball. But I definitely think he's warranted a chance and a selection there. And, you know, it could definitely pay off him being a long-term opener, which sort of outside of Warner, we've struggled to find over the last half decade. So I think he definitely comes in and starts in that first test. And then you've got Lasagna and Smith. I mean, my goodness, can you get a better 3 and 4 in the world?
Does it get any better?
Like, than that? You just know, you know, you back them almost one of those two hit a century every alternating test that they play.
And I just hope Smith comes out and scores 7,000 runs. Yeah. Like, I honestly want it to be utterly boring how much runs he's scoring. I just want to turn on the TV and be like, wow, he's still there. Like, someone
150.
Somebody stop this bloke.
Yeah. And then Head, I've got him. He's had some great Sheffield Shield form, and I feel like he's finding his feet in the Australian team. So that's a very solid top five. And the strength in that top five gives cause to pause, if you'll pardon the pun, in relation to Ken Green coming at six there. Or you could play Wade, and then obviously Payne, and then you could play a bowling all-rounder if an injury persisted to one of the cartel, in the form of Sean Abbott or Michael Neese. Now, Michael Neese has been in the squad for a while now. He's hit a century this Sheffield season, and he's also taken 10 wickets. Sean Abbott's been taken 14 wickets and hit a century as well. That was key to the New South Wales victory the other week. So I think either of those guys could do a job. And I just think we've turned a corner in Australian cricket. When you've got guys that you could almost like interchange. There was a period there, especially after the Sandpaper Gate, where, you know, they were looking for guys to come in, you know, like, you know, anyone to come in, you know, the people averaging 30, 35. But these guys are, you know, they're talking about Pukowski averages 55 in Shield cricket, you know, Abbott and Nessa in great form, you know, and they've got that ability to bowl and bat. And I just love the versatility that adds to the modern game of Test cricket. So when you've got this squad of 17, and effectively all of them, I would be comfortable with them playing in the 12. That's a good issue to have, and that's why they're number one test in the world, test team in the world.
Great spot to be in. I mean, you got to contrast everything right now to last summer. And, oh, was it last summer or whenever the Sandpaper Gate was? Sorry, dates are slipping my mind. But it was a crappy feeling having an average team and having India come over here and win their first series ever over here on Australian soil. So it's a great spot to be in now to be confused on who we're going to pick because there's so many good options. So I'd much rather be in this situation, pick the wrong team of a bunch of great blokes than be in the situation of not knowing who to pick because your team's obviously and considerably weaker than it can be. So I'm loving it.
Yep, Andrew. Well, I think that's a good place to leave the discussion. Now, again, send through your thoughts. I know we've got some great passionate listeners out there who love their cricket and are looking forward to diving into a summer of cricket ahead. But just before we go, we haven't done questions the last couple of episodes, but I've got a question coming in here from Joel Schiffler, who's soon to be in hotel quarantine on his return to Sydney. He's looking at a weekend multi in Shires cricket. He's gone Cormac O'Connor over 39.5 runs, and he's gone Pooley over 11.5. I think he's got something like $3.75 there for that. So not bad odds. Not sure about Pooley at 11.5. We'll see if he can get into double figures, but O'Connor surely a lock for 50. So there's your answer to that. I think you've gone well there. And potentially I'll be looking at something like Kovacic 5+ wickets. But if you want to add a bit more, if you want to add a bit more odds and value to that list. So any questions coming in from your end, Joe?
No, mate. I'm being a bit dry. I'm a bit disappointed in the listening base. I need more questions coming through the pipeline. So if you're listening, hit my line or hit Mr. Pools.
We've actually got one coming through now from Patrick Fagali. He says, Joe, will you marry me?
Oh, mate, yeah, we've got the details all in order. I don't want to give away too much, but Paddy, I think you knew the answer to that one before you asked it, mate.
And we all know what that means. It means that you can have 100 at the reception.
Oh, don't worry, we know.
King of the boys. King of the boys, there we go.
It's in the works.
There we have it. There are questions from our loyal fan base. A bit silly there from some of the boys, but it is coming in the silly season, and you've got to respect that. that's where we'll leave it. Thanks for tuning in this week. If you're still somehow hanging on and listening to the podcast. But until next week, stay golden as we stay here at Political Football. Substance over style, policy over politics.
Peace.